Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. Hello to you, the listener. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Gail Seiler, your host for today. Coming up on today's show, Pat Schlaubaum interviews someone impacted by the volcano in Hawaii, and we'll speak with a team of scientists at ISU who recently received funding from NASA for a new project in which they'll study stress on humans in space. And Alex Fafar from the Ames Historical Society will be here to talk about Iowa Museum Month. And of course, it's Friday, so we have Dennis Hart with the news, and this week we have Dennis here live in the studio.
Gail, it's good to be here. After 33 weeks recorded with you, it's nice to be with you and see you in person.
It's good to have you here.
All right. Well, as you know, normally we would start this rundown chronologically with Sunday's Tribune, but because of all the rain we had yesterday and its impact on the city, we are starting with today's Ames Tribune, which the front page headline you will see when you get it in your mailbox is "Streets Succumb to Flash Flooding." We had between 4 3/4 and 6.5 inches of rain yesterday morning in Ames. Now, as you might imagine, that caused big problems all over town. Parts of numerous streets flooded, including Bloomington Road, Kent Avenue, Bristol Drive, Stang Road, East Lincoln Way, Ferndale Avenue, Duff Avenue, and, yes, the Grand Avenue underpass. 3 feet of water accumulated in that underpass, and at least 3 vehicles were caught in it, including a post office truck. Fire crews used an inflatable raft to rescue the stranded postal worker and get the mail to you. Some cornfields and ditches south of Ames also flooded. U.S. Highway 69 briefly closed between U.S. 30 and Iowa Highway 210. Between 30 and 40 people in Ames lost power but quickly got it back. Now, Squaw Creek at Lincoln Way crested at or above flood stage this morning, and I can tell you that Brookside Park at 6:30 this morning was underwater. It will start receding. The South Skunk River crested at or above flood stage this morning on Highway 30. That could cause some problems at the Hunziker Youth Sports Complex. But the rivers and creeks should be receding now, and that's good news. Now let's go back to Sunday's edition of the Tribune, where the big front page story was the same one that dominated the Boone News Republican. It was about Iowa Republican Senator Joni Ernst's annual Roast and Ride fundraiser, which started in Des Moines this past Saturday and wound up at the Central Iowa Expo Center outside Boone. Hundreds of people showed up to see and hear Ernst, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, and the keynote speaker, Congressman Trey Gowdy of South Carolina. Ernst told the crowd about what she considers President Trump's recent successes, including judges he's appointed across the country and the nation's low jobless rate. Governor Reynolds, who will face Democrat Fred Hubble in the general election this fall, said that election is critical because, in her words, it's going to help decide who we are as a people and what kind of Iowa we're going to pass on to our children. Congressman Gowdy, who will retire from office this year, said the Republican Party needs to tell people how it's the party of hope. Of course, there's no Monday edition of the Trib, but Tuesday's edition reported that the Iowa Board of Regents Property and Facilities Committee has recommended moving forward with 4 major projects at Iowa State. One involves a $28 million expansion of the Jordan Business Building. That project involves adding 40,000 square feet to the building, which would be used for student-focused instructional and collaboration space, faculty and graduate student offices, and common spaces to support a variety of events. The project would be funded through university money and private donations. The committee also recommended going ahead with plans for a $21 million feed mill and grain science complex at Curtis Farm, $11 million to renovate the Memorial Union, and $2 million to renovate Curtis Hall. All of these projects need the Board of Regents' approval, and they are scheduled to be discussed at the Regents' next meeting in August. Tuesday's Trib also reported on the ribbon-cutting ceremony that took place last Saturday to mark the completion of a new 10-foot-wide paved bike trail that connects Ames and Gilbert for both bicyclists and pedestrians. The trail is along Gretton Street in Gilbert, which is known as Grant Avenue within the Ames city limits. And Tuesday's Trib also reported that the Story Theater Company is going to premiere Beauty and the Beast Jr. tonight, Friday, June 15th, at the Ames City Auditorium on Clark Avenue. Showtime, 7 o'clock. Wednesday's Tribune was loaded with news about both the Ames City Council and the Story County Board of Supervisors, both of which held meetings on Tuesday. The council once again took up the issue of changing zoning regulations on or near a stretch of Lincoln Way. And instead of marching straight toward changing those restrictions, the council amended the ordinance that would have altered the standards and then tabled its approval for a later time. Now, the city hopes new standards are going to encourage more urban commercial development on the so-called downtown gateway focus area, which lies on both sides of Lincoln Way, between Duff and Grand Avenues. Now, before tabling the ordinance that would have changed existing standards, the council approved an amendment to it. Instead of making some properties non-conforming, they would be designated pre-existing. What's the difference, you ask? Well, according to Ames Planning and Zoning Director Kelly Diekman, it's that owners of pre-existing buildings can expand their buildings as much as they want on the existing site. Business owners in the Lincoln Way area have opposed zoning changes that would limit the ability of some of their properties, including automotive services and warehouses, from expanding. The council is going to revisit all of this on June 26th. At the Board of Supervisors meeting earlier Tuesday, a representative from ISG Field Services told the supervisors that his company's inspection work in county areas where the Dakota Access Pipeline was built is not done. Evan Delvell's appearance at the supervisors meeting came 2 weeks after landowners from Boone, Story, and Webster counties told the board that the pipeline's installation has led to the mixing of topsoil and subsoil and soil compaction and some drainage problems. That makes it more difficult to farm the area. Story County had contracted with ISG to inspect pipeline construction. Delvall said ISG inspectors are still on the job resolving some issues. The pipeline carries oil, as you know, from North Dakota to southern Illinois, cutting diagonally across Iowa from the state's northwestern corner to its southeastern one. About 9 miles of the pipeline moves through Story County's southern half. There was more in Wednesday's Tribune, including word that the trial for the Nebraska man who allegedly helped rob residents of a campus town apartment complex last October has been moved up to July 24th. 25-year-old Bangtan Wool's trial originally was set to begin in August. Another Nebraska man has already pleaded guilty in connection with that incident at the Foundry apartment complex in the 2300 block of Lincoln Way. One more note from Wednesday's Tribune, a feature story, a good one, about 19-year-old Marina Lan. She's just graduated from Ames High. Now, most high school students spend the summer after they graduate by relaxing, getting a job, getting ready for college. But not Marina, who came to Ames 3 years ago from Beijing, China. This summer after graduation is all about science for her. She is spending the next few months working side by side with graduate students in an Iowa State University laboratory. She will be studying zebrafish in preparation for a career she hopes to dedicate to science. Then this fall, she will attend Washington and Lee University in Virginia to study biochemistry. Marina Land, good for you. Yesterday's Trib, had more on this week's Ames City Council meeting. It reported that even though the ordinance establishing a 25% cap on rental properties in certain Ames neighborhoods went into effect 3 weeks ago, it's become evident that the council is not done with it yet, not by any means. Several homeowners from the West Side neighborhood near Iowa State told the council they would like the decision that included their neighborhood in the cap to be reversed. They said they did not think West Side was going to be included under the cap, and they told the council their neighborhood is where Iowa State students should be living. The cap would prohibit additional single-family homes from turning into rental properties in which ISU students theoretically would live. Now, in the West Side neighborhood, 59% of the single-family homes are rental properties. In addition to West Side, the 25% rental cap applies to the north section of the South Campus area neighborhood, to the Colonial Village neighborhood, to the College Creek Old Ames Middle School neighborhood, to the Oakwood Forest neighborhood, to the Oak Riverside neighborhood, and to the Old Edwards neighborhood. Council decided to take up the West Side neighborhood's request at a future meeting. Also this week, the council spent a couple of hours talking about a potential ordinance that could offer rental cap exceptions to some homeowners who experience hardships because of the cap. Now, some homeowners say because of that cap, they cannot do what they want with their homes, whether it's renting them out or selling them as rental properties. After numerous members of the public spoke both in favor of and in opposition to any rental cap exceptions, the council decided to consider such exceptions at a future meeting. Also in Thursday's Trib, word that work is continuing on the third and final phase of Iowa State University's Jack Trice Stadium Improvements Project, which will create a green space between the stadium and Ryman Gardens. That project began 4 years ago. So far, the south end of the stadium has been enclosed and a new south entrance and indoor club facility constructed. Now the final element of the plan, a green space, replacing a former parking lot, is scheduled to wrap up by this fall. Quick note from the crime beat in Thursday's Trib, a sixth suspect has now been arrested in connection with a robbery that took place last April in Ames. 22-year-old Arish Shak Hurd of Des Moines has been charged with robbery, theft, and burglary in connection with an incident in the 1100 block of Grand Avenue. The robbery took place at a house party. And one more note, Gail. Hundreds of competitive bike racers are coming back to Main Street and to the Iowa State Research Park this weekend. And no, it's not the Register's annual Great Bike Ride Across Iowa. This is the second annual Ames Grand Prix. About 300 cyclists are expected to race in two divisions. Saturday's route runs through Main Street and parts of 5th and 6th Streets and Burnett Avenue. Sunday's route is near the Research Park. Now, race conditions are expected to be sunny, hot, humid, and, yes, sweaty, with temperatures near 97 or 100 degrees. But, you know, Gail, after all we went through yesterday, I don't think any of us are going to complain about a little hot weather this weekend, are we?
I don't know. Maybe it'll dry out people's basements. But if it's humid, won't help with that, I guess.
It'll also help dry out Brookside Park, which is underwater.
Yeah. Yeah, you can see the effects of the rain all around the town. You're going to come in live again next week?
I will, absolutely.
Okay.
You bet.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Barring flood or other acts, yeah.
We have definitely had some extreme weather recently. Of course, the flooding in the past few days. But we don't have the kinds of natural disasters that exist in other places. So KHOI reporter Pat Schlaubaum is bringing us a firsthand account of the volcano that is impacting people in Hawaii. He spoke with a friend of his who is visiting the mainland from Hawaii.
Ed Hinesley from Hawaii, visiting here on the States. Where are you from there in Hawaii?
I live in Fern Forest, which is about 15 minutes away from the volcano.
That's the Kilauea?
That's Kilauea, yeah. The crater is actually called Halemaumau.
Uh-huh. Well, tell us a little bit about that area, if you could.
The volcano village is what's being affected the most up at the moment. So I've been to the crater a few times, which is not something that most people do.
It was something that you wanted to do. So
absolutely.
So you park your car and then walk over after dark?
Yeah. Walk up to, there's a road that's not lit that goes to the volcano itself. It's the crater. So, and it takes a little bit to get there, but you just follow the glow. And it's a very beautiful, surreal experience. About a quarter mile from it, you can actually feel the power of the lava that's underneath the ground. You can feel, and you can smell the sulfur that's coming out of the ground. And so right now, there is actually no lava in that crater, where before at night you could see the red glow. Now there's nothing. There's no glow. All that lava. And what I've just found out, too, is that the lava that's flowing out of Kilauea, some of that lava is flowing down into Lower Puna. And that's the area where that's being the most affected right now. And they're saying that the lava that is coming out of those fissures is new lava. So the question is, where is the old lava?
So before, when you went there, before the activity of recent weeks, describe that crater scene. Was it just a glowing mass, or were there different floating tectonics or
it's just walking up to it. Once you get into that red glow, it feels like you're on Mars. Like literally there's fissures that where there's smoke and sulfur coming out of the ground and parts that are, they're white. It's very alien looking, especially at midnight or so, looking at the ground, and you'll see just patches of white from all the sulfur that's just coming out of the ground. And you see this what almost looks like hair, or you think it's a plant, but it's actually what they call Pele's hair. It's peridot that once it's superheated and then cooled, it looks like hair. And so it's crystal, and it grows. It looks like a bunch of hairs all bunched together. And it's very amazing because you would never know that it wasn't organic.
Like 2 or 3 feet in length or more?
Oh, I'd say, yeah, two to three feet at least. And it's green in color, but during certain times of the day, it looks golden. So when the wind blows, and the wind blows a lot up there because you're at 4,200 feet. And when the wind blows up there, it just looks like just grass just flowing in the wind. And it's a sight to see. If anyone's interested, just go online and look up Pele's hair. Yeah. And go on to YouTube and you'll find some videos and they'll show you. You'll see some beautiful sights of it.
So, and after dark, could you describe the light source of the glow, you mentioned it was perpendicular, the light.
Yeah. Well, looking down into the crater, when you look down into it, you'll see that there are fissures in between, inside the bowl, it just looks like cracks, where you can see the light of the magma. So, with those cracks, when you see those cracks, and you look, if you look just directly at it, you can see that the light, it's so hot in there that the light is actually, it's beaming sideways through these fissures, through these cracks in the hot molten lava. You'll see these lights, and it looks like lasers. This looks like a laser light. But when you look at it, you could just tell that it's, you know, the light is bent from the heat and from, I'm sure it's the gases that are pushing, you know, pushing out that light and heat at the same time. It's very amazing to know that it's so hot that the light is actually bending sideways.
Yeah, you're describing a very surreal image. And of course, now unavailable to go and look into the crater.
It's no longer there.
So the magma in that crater has, that pressure is being released through the fissures?
Well, what's happening is that the mountain is so high up that it, you know, it's filled when that lava pressure is all the way up to the top at 4,200 feet. It's not actually flowing out of that crater. It's what it's done is it's drained down through lava tubes all the way down to almost sea level, where people live at Leilani Estates. All those fissures that have opened up, they're maybe a couple hundred, maybe 150, 200 feet above sea level. And those fissures, so 4,000 feet down, all this pressure has come down out of the volcano and through the lava tubes, and now is flowing out through the fissures. And it's just decimating land.
Do you have friends in that area?
I have a lot of friends in that area.
How has their day changed by having this active flow?
Well, a lot of people are having to find homes and places to stay, shelters. There's a lot of people that have opened up. Of course, it's Hawaii's, the big island is the Ohana. It's the Aloha Island. I mean, there's a lot of heart, a lot of beautiful people on that island. Something like this happens, they open up their homes, they open up their, you know, there's acreage everywhere. So people just, plant a tent and everybody just goes about their business. For the most part, living in Lower Puna consists of there's a lot of hippies and people that live, and they're what you would call minimalists. So they live in communities, they share, they need very little, so they work very, they don't work a lot. And their life consists of not just, I don't know anybody that really works a 9-to-5. I don't know too many people that work, you know, those long hour days, because most of them don't have attachments to their homes, or, you know, they live with other people or they live together. So when you have a bunch of people living together and you have this person that goes and picks fruit or coconuts, you know, then you got coconuts and fruit that came from the jungle. So it's there's a lot of give and take. So a lot of these people, some of my friends, I just offered one of my friends to come up. And he said he was okay. He said, if I need to, I will. But, you know, he's got work and he's got a place. He had a backup plan. So, but I've made the offer to a few people. So they know that if things continue, which they will continue this way, I've had friends that have lost. The land is completely gone. It's all just covered in lava now. So, there's a place called Some Land that's gone. My friend, I just read her Facebook profiles, and it said that land that she just purchased last year is now a lava field, and which is really close to another community called Cinderland. And Cinderland is they're under threat right now of this lava headed their way.
Is there still electricity and that kind of infrastructure?
No. No electricity. There's, people have generators. So if the power goes out, usually someone will have a backup generator. They'll plug into their, they can just plug right into their homes. People have, they're pretty resilient out there. The geothermal plant that I just found out a couple days ago has been wiped out. It's pretty much gone now. There was a threat of it exploding, and that was people's biggest concerns was if this chemical plant exploded, if it would set off more earthquakes and open more fissures. But they had a town meeting saying that they took care of it. They flushed out the lines. There'd be very minimal chemicals in those pipes.
So it's been knocked out, but no major earthquake or major explosions.
Yeah, no major explosions.
We think of Hawaii as resort areas. Are there community beaches and things that have been impacted also?
This area particularly is a major tourist area. So we have Uncle Robert's, which is the Hawaiian sovereign community that you go to every Thursday. There's a market. People bring their stuff. And a lot of people like to bring their homemade goods and crafts. And it's tax-free because they're selling it in a sovereign area. And then there would be the Hawaiian band that would play every Thursday. You'd have musicians waiting around the stage just to play with these legendary musicians. But in 1955, the Pu'u'o'o crater had just started spurting out lava, and it just missed Uncle's. It less than a quarter mile. It literally goes right around Uncle's. So when you go out there's a lava field and it just hugs the corner of Uncle Robert's area. And this one opened up down the road. So now Uncle's is just going, the only way you're going to be able to get to Uncle's is to cross a lava field or take a boat to get to Uncle's now. It's going to be really isolated.
Uncle Robert's is possibly going to be impacted this time. It survived 1955.
Yeah, it survived that.
Has there been other events comparable to this in the last 150 years?
Oh, absolutely. Mauna Lea had threatened to take out the city of Hilo, and I believe that was 1912. So, of course, it was a smaller town back then, but still a major town for the Big Island.
Have people been building and living under the, assumption that there would be a volcano someday? Or is life there somewhat tentative? What's in the mindset of those local people?
There are some people that, they don't take this as a hardship. They know the concerns of living on a volcano. They know that. So they know that if it happens, they have to, they're mind is set to move forward and to move on. There's a generational gap between the last time this happened to this time happening. So people forget that they live in a place that this can actually happen, and it's happening. But there are some people that they have no backup plan. People are sleeping in their cars right now. Some people are, they don't have anything. There's a lot of looting going on, as far as I've heard, down in that area. Mm-hmm. So my area, there's not all the scavengers have gone down there so they can go pick away at the properties that are abandoned. And there's a lot of that, believe it or not, on Big Island.
What's the assessment? What's your thinking on your home?
Well, the biggest threat that we have right now is just the gases, the SO2 gases, sulfur dioxide gas. It's coming up from down below. So we are west of that, of the fissures that have opened up, of all that lava. Whereas before, we were east of the volcano, which the wind blows from east to west. So we didn't have that, the sulfur gases coming into our breathing space. And now, because those fissures have opened up and the wind is blowing up towards us, now all of the area and the people in the area are breathing SO2 gases. By the time it gets to us, though, it's roughly an hour away, so it's a little diluted down, but still, people are getting headaches and getting nauseous, and it's not healthy to breathe.
What's most, for any listener that wants to assist your community there in Hawaii, what would you recommend?
Well, the biggest thing is, look into any emergency aid for the island, and what people need that are living there is they need like the paint masks,
The respirators,
respirator masks. Yeah, preferably the ones that you use for chemicals. So painters use the ones that keep the fumes out, and the filters can be changed in and out. So those can, that's a big thing that's needed up there. Find out who and where, what agencies need donations for, to keep these people that are staying in some of these shelters, and donate money to food and for supplies to these agencies. And besides that, I think island living is easy living. You can go and pitch a tent by the ocean, right on the beach, and sleep easy. But I think the main thing is where people need is food. And, because a lot of people have been displaced. The only thing I can say is, just send your prayers out to the people out there in Hawaii. And, if you have family out there, make sure you keep in touch with them. Let them know that people out here are thinking about them.
Okay. Eddie Hinesley, help your friends on the islands. And appreciate your stay here on the mainland and your time here with the Yankton Sundance.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks to Pat Schlarbaum for that interview with Ed Hinesley from Hawaii. As you heard at the end, they mentioned the Sundance. The Sundance is perhaps the most famous of the Plains ceremonial dances, and it was practiced by many Sioux communities as well as other Native American tribes. In 1883, the U.S. government outlawed the Sundance because it was seen as, quote, uncivilized and barbaric. So Native Americans went underground with the Sundance until 1978, when the American Indian Religious Freedom Act legalized it. Now the Sundance is celebrated in several locations in June in South Dakota, and it sounds like Pat and Eddie will be going. That was some sounds of lava erupting in Hawaii. NASA recently funded 10 proposals to help answer questions about astronaut health and performance during future long-duration missions, and one of the winning proposals was submitted by a team from Iowa State University. Three members of the team came into KHOI this past week to tell us about their project. I spoke with Michael Dornike, a professor in the Department of Industrial and Manufacturing Systems Engineering, Tor Finset, a graduate student in aerospace engineering, and Nir Karen from the Department of Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering. What is it that NASA is trying to find out or study in all of these projects?
Yeah, so this particular solicitation was really, they're looking for seedling ideas. So NASA puts out roadmaps to say, hey, these are the research areas that we have gaps in, that we are concerned about, usually tied in some ways to future missions and their own roadmap of the work that they're going to do. And so they're really asking for folks to submit ideas, seedling projects of how could you address these gaps.
And they're all related, if I understand it correctly, they're all related to humans in space, not space exploration that's unpeopled.
Yeah, there's different directorates within NASA. So you're right, this is the Human Exploration Directorate. And so they're concerned about how humans behave in space, how they cope with being in space, things like that.
And your proposal is called Adaptive Stress Training for Hazardous Conditions. Did I get it right?
That's right.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
So what is your proposal actually looking at?
So I'm going to let Tor take that one.
Yeah. What we're really trying to do is help astronauts enhance their performance in some of the tasks they may do in space. And a lot of this comes from the astronaut we have on staff here, Clayton Anderson, who did a mission on the ISS and also the space shuttle. And through some of his personal experiences, we've just learned how hard it is to actually be an astronaut and the stress that they undergo. Oftentimes when we think about performance, we do drill training, which is commonly employed by the military. But through that repetitive task, what ends up happening is that over time, if they're exposed to something novel situation, that some of their performance may degrade. And so what we're really trying to do is then help these astronauts handle that stress that comes with the task to make sure that they don't have any detriments when they actually go up in space and they can actually accomplish a mission.
So how will your project actually look at that?
Well, to kind of augment some of the training that exists out there, you read the title of our proposal, the Adaptive Virtual Reality Stress Training System, and it's kind of a mouthful. Really, it's putting a number of pieces together. So virtual reality, tying that to some of the adaptive systems, which is actually Dr. Dornick's specialty, and then also using some of the training that exists out there to deal with stress, and then applying that to astronauts. And we can go into each one of those pieces, too.
Okay.
So the basic idea is that, while they're training to do tasks, we also want to put them in situations that are more stressful so that they learn to cope with the stress. So that, when it's really happening, that the stress isn't stealing, capability from them. So that the stress isn't degrading their performance because they're dealing with coping with the stress rather than dealing with the task.
There is a book that was released about 5 years ago. It's called Choke. And the question they ask, why people freeze despite all the training that they go through and do not perform the way they expected to perform? Is there a way by which we can prepare them better to deal with this? And this area is very prominent in what we call cognitive engineering. The one thing about space is if there is fire, you cannot run out. You have to deal with it inside, which adds another dimension to the response. So all the process of soldiers that go to the battlefield after training and encounter shooting in their area and freeze cannot do anything is something that we realize that we may be able with technology and knowledge to overcome. There is a very interesting story on the Science Channel that they present on the Mir space station. This is the Russian space station. When they had the fire, and the American astronaut who responded that, he froze and could not respond for about 5 minutes until he was able to recoup. So 5 minutes can be really critical. Can we prevent this from happening? Can we prevent from these stress to take over by using technology and incorporate it into their training instead of just continuously repeat the same exposure that we use in covering a gap of knowledge? Because this is not the case. Gap of knowledge doesn't solve the problem. It's the cognitive readiness that we need to bring to the table that is a missing piece currently in training.
What we're really trying to do is we want to measure a person's stress level and then actually adapt the training during execution in the virtual environment so that if we want to up the stress because they're not stressed enough or we want to lower the stress because they're starting to freeze, we can tune the stress level that they're experiencing to whatever level of stress we think is the right thing at this moment. And over time, we want to train them with ever-increasing levels of stress that they can handle so that they eventually become inoculated to that stress and that they can perform under these stressful conditions.
And how do you monitor that stress?
So that comes a lot to the psychology and physiology behind this. Currently, what ends up happening is that a lot of the stress is due to appraisal of your situation, and that causes, either a threat or a challenge appraisal, which you can either run from the lion or you can, I'm going to take this lion down. But it'll end up sending a cascade of changes throughout your body, whether that be changes to your heart rate, your blood pressure, your hormone levels. And a lot of this is what ends up disrupting a lot of your attention, your working memory, so anything that you need to perform the task. And so by monitoring some of the heart rate, the blood pressure, even sweating on your fingertips if you're nervous, we can fine-tune this to say that this person's getting really stressed out or they're not stressed enough, and then we can help them gradually become inoculated to the situation.
We do it in conjunction to their performance that we measure in response to a task that we monitor. That's what's unique about the tool. Mm-hmm. I also would like to emphasize why virtual reality. I mean, virtual reality is a term that is used quite often and not many really understand the uniqueness of virtual reality. There are three factors that affect immersion in virtual reality. It's all about immersion. The one is what is known as a place illusion. Once you're in virtual reality, it's really hard to ignore the fact that you're in a scene. If you've been placed on a high-rise building and you look down, you'll have a fear of heights, even though you know that you're not. on a high-rise building. The second factor is plausibility. And plausibility is a dynamic factor. If you drive in a virtual car, in a virtual reality, and a kid will jump in front of you, your physiological mental response will be as much as it will be while you drive a car. It will not happen if you have a large screen and TV in there. And the third one is what we call situational awareness. Situational awareness in virtual reality, we completely control. So there is nothing else but what we want you to be exposed to in comparison to being in any other type of training.
The other factor about virtual reality, too, is that it's just cost-effective. Current NASA practices to train some of their astronauts, they use a lot of big mock-ups, which can simulate, obviously, the real-life scenario and task, such as if you're going to put smoke inside the ISS. And they also use some virtual reality for some of their spacewalks. But I think the big component that they're missing and we're trying to address here is really getting at that, changing that physiology and then changing the environment to match that and then helping gradually ease the people into it.
And the virtual reality you're talking about is these head-mounted devices that people wear? Is that what it would be?
Yes.
I mean, you're not creating a whole room that's a virtual reality.
Well, it actually started there. So the Virtual Reality Application Center at Iowa State has a six-sided high-definition room, 10 by 10 by 10, that the original International Space Station simulation that Tor and Nir developed was in there, and then they ported it over to a virtual reality headset. So we have different environments in which we can do this, and it really depends on sort of what are the requirements of the training to decide, which environment to use.
The C6 is a better suit for collaborative efforts when multiple people can be in one space and easily interact with the environment. And the head-mounted device is more of a person in the environment.
The research will be done at ISU.
Correct.
And what is the role of each of you in the project?
Well, it's a highly collaborative team. We have a couple other project members. So Warren Franke is in kinesiology, and he is an expert in physiology. So the whole idea of monitoring people and monitoring their stress level in real time, so we have a signal to say, hey, this person's stress is medium or high. I'm the principal investigator, so as Tor said, my area is adaptive systems. So how do we take that signal of, okay, this person is at stress level medium, but we really want them to be high, and so now we need to change the environment. Nir is an expert in virtual reality. And Tor is the graduate student who has to put it all together and do the actual work.
And I'm interested in the way people make decisions in real-life situations. And so their performance under stress is what really intrigued me into getting into virtual reality, because it's one way to do it without putting people at risk.
And we have one other person, Steve Vardaman, in the statistics department, who helps us with our experimental design when we try to actually evaluate how effective our system is.
What will be produced? Will it be knowledge? Will it be technology? Will it be something that NASA can actually go ahead and use, or is it more preparation for that kind of follow-up?
All of the above.
And I would say that the real goal is knowledge, sort of further understanding of what's effective. We'll build technology along the way, but it's really in furtherance of testing. It's great to have an idea. It's great to build some technology. But until we actually test it and see, do we get the effects that we expect? Can we actually make some claims that this is a more effective way to do stress training than some other ways? How much technology we build is sort of how much do we need to run the evaluation that we need to run so that we can really be confident that, what we're claiming is really true.
And I think today's challenges in general require interdisciplinary teams in order to get to maximize what can be done.
And the university, I think, is doing a much better job of sort of encouraging that kind of cross-departmental collaboration. So we're also all members of the Human-Computer Interaction Program, which is a center that sort of lives between departments, and so that gives us a mechanism with which to collaborate.
Do you think that there are any applications for life on Earth for this kind of research?
Absolutely.
Tell us about those.
Well, so again, we're trying to train people to handle stress in hazardous or life-threatening situations, and so this can be applied to anybody, not just astronauts. Because of virtual reality, we can create any sort of environment, whether that be for bomb disposal, for pilots, CDC, people working with infectious viruses, police officers, firefighters.
Mm-hmm. I think every mission-critical occupation is a really good subject for this type of technology and knowledge.
When you measure physical stress and physical responses, there's a lot of variation that is seen in that kind of data?
Absolutely. One of the things we have a very hard time with is the fact that measuring stress is so different between people. And again, like I mentioned appraisal before, it really comes down to the things that you're stressed out by. Are you stressed out by heights? Are you stressed out by spiders, by snakes? Everyone's a little bit different. And because of that, we respond different physiologically. And so one of the challenges with this is really building the technology to recognize patterns in your stress response so that our system knows, you know, when to change the virtual reality environment and when not to.
Even within the same person, you might be more stressed by something tomorrow than you are today, mm-hmm. because tomorrow maybe you're fatigued and you have other stressors. And so so even within an individual, it can be different day to day.
So you got the grant. You just recently found out that you were awarded this the funding for this project. What's the first few things you have to do?
You know, so we wrote a proposal, fairly detailed, came up with a plan, a timeline, things like that. But now we really have to put detail to some of these tasks. You know, we sort of know when things are due, but, you know, how do we get to that milestone? So so we'll sit down together as a team and sort of flush out that program plan. And then we need to talk to NASA. You know, they usually assign a program manager. And so you form a fairly tight collaboration with that person. You know, hopefully if you have a situation where they're giving you incremental feedback so that we continue to meet their needs. And frankly, they're the customer. And so they know their domain better than anyone. And so that's a great resource for us to make sure that we're actually solving real problems rather than kind of going off in a tangent somewhere. But then, you know, we're kind of all antsy to start the actual mm-hmm. work.
Just to mention, we have astronaut on campus, but we have also an International Space Station flight director on campus as well. So we have these resources as well that will be very helpful.
At the end of the day, this is really about decision making, and it's not just the astronaut who's making a decision. There's a whole team behind it. You know, the astronauts are in a very hostile environment, and they have literally a team of hundreds supporting them. And so we want to reduce their stress, but how do we create the situation that the decision making all around is better? You know, we're at a point now where we have sensors that are able to measure heart rate in real time, even some other physiological signals. We have techniques now, artificial intelligence techniques, that allows us to interpret those signals very quickly and into something meaningful. You know, I don't really want to know your heart rate. I want to know whether you're stressed. And so there's a leap there. And then we can feed that into an adaptive system in a fairly high-fidelity virtual environment that's easy to program. So it's sort of all these different technologies, all these different research fields are at a maturity level where we can put it all together and see if we can make something that actually works in real time. Now we just have to do it.
That was Michael Dornike, Tor Finset, and Nir Karen, members of an ISU team that recently was awarded project funding from NASA. An interesting side note on that, my son-in-law works for NASA in Washington, D.C., and he saw the list of 10 funded projects under that new research area, and he sent me the list because he saw that ISU was actually the first one on the list. So very quickly I thought, we have to get these folks on the radio. So I emailed Dr. Dornike, and he responded very quickly and said, yes, we'd love to come on the radio and talk about it. I'll bring my grad student, etc. And when they came in, he said that he actually hadn't gotten official notice and wasn't aware that they had received the funding when he got my email. So through my connection at NASA, KHOI got a little bit of a scoop on that interview and that project funding. We were just listening to some ceremonial songs that might be heard if you were to go to the Sundance in South Dakota in June. We hoped to have Alex Fafar from the Iowa History Center join us, but Alex wasn't able to make it this morning, so I'm going to give you some information that he was going to share with you. It's Iowa Museum Week from Monday through Sunday, the 18th to the 24th of June. What that means is that there are special tours and events going on all across the state at the various museums that we have in Iowa. And here at the Ames History Center, they have a special event on Saturday to kick off Iowa Museum Week. And that is this Saturday, tomorrow, from 12 to 3, an ice cream social. They will have free ice cream, and it's open to all. There will be free activities for kids, sponsored by the Ames Community Arts Council and the Ames Sylvan Learning Center. And it's their way of thanking the community for their support of the Iowa History Center and their way of welcoming everyone in to have some ice cream and see their current exhibits. A couple other things to let you know about going on. Ames on the Half Shell takes place tonight at Banshell Park from 5 to 8. And this week it is Vivace. You can come there and you can hear great music and bring food and friends and have a great time this evening at Banshell Park. You can also see 9 to 5, the musical, is going on at Actors Theater here in Ames. Or if you're in the mood, you can see Beauty and the Beast Jr., which is at the Black Box Theater on South Dayton Avenue. So that gives you an idea of just a few things you can do this weekend, and we hope you have a nice weekend. Stay cool. It sounds like it's going to be hot, and I know a lot of people are still mopping up from the flooding and the rain we had, so good luck with that. This has been KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Local Talk. I've been your host, Gail Seiler. Local Talk is broadcast on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can also listen to today's Local Talk show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. Local Talk was engineered by Jackie Norman. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. If you value the stories and interviews that we bring you on Local Talk, why not show your support by becoming a member of KHOI? You can do it online. Just go to the website, khoifm.org, and look for the donate button. Or you can call 515-292-2878. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as audience and supporter is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. The Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun every Saturday, located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza. The farmers market brings fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment.